Welcome to Electric Politics. I am George Kenney. Today I'm very pleased to bring you a special guest, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Dr. Roberts is somewhere in the same league, I think, with Gore Vidal in being one of the foremost critics of President Bush's criminal operation. Unlike Vidal, however, Dr. Roberts brings the additional heft of having been a central figure in the Reagan Revolution and an intellectual leader within the conservative establishment for decades. In this conversation, we talk about economics, trade, jobs, foreign policy, politics, religion, and patriotism, among other things. It's a long podcast, but it'll go by fairly quickly, so settle in. I'm very honored today to have Dr. Paul Craig Roberts as a guest. Dr. Roberts has been a hero, really, of mine for many, many years. Indeed, I started reading his writings back when I was a graduate school at the University of Chicago a long time ago. Dr. Roberts is now the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He has had an amazing career where he's been a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank associated with Stanford University, distinguished fellow at the Cato Institute. He held the William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. From 1981 to 1982, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy. And I think for those of our listeners who don't really know the history, it might be helpful, Dr. Roberts, for you to explain a little bit about that background. You were at the Wall Street Journal and then in the Treasury Department. You were really one of the leaders of President Reagan's economic policy team, and you had a major role here in Washington, didn't you?
Yes, I did, for a number of years. The United States was faced with what seemed to be a hard-to-solve economic problem. Mm-hmm. The change in demand management of the post-war period had broken down. We were no longer able to maintain full employment without rising rates of inflation. Mm-hmm. And it got so bad that Milton Friedman actually said that the higher rates of inflation themselves were no longer having any positive employment effects and were starting to cause unemployment. So we had what was called stagflation. It destroyed right. Jimmy Carter's presidency.
Right.
And the Keynesians had no solution. At the time, I was in the congressional staff. I was the chief economist for the Republicans on the House Budget Committee, and I was later in the Senate on the Joint Economic Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution that we came up with is known as supply-side economics.
Right. There were two or three of you who really developed these ideas.
Well, there's a lot of mythology about all of that. It really was something developed in the congressional budget process, and leading Democrats also played a role in that, such as Lloyd Benson, mm-hmm. Russell Long, Sam Nunn. But I don't have time for all that. The fact, the gist of the matter is that what we did was reverse the policy mix. Mm-hmm. The Keynesians had used easy money to drive up demand mm-hmm. and high tax rates to restrain inflation. But what the high tax rates were really restraining was output, real output. And so the response to easy money was just for prices to rise.
Mm-hmm.
So we reversed that and moved to a tighter money monetary policy and cut the tax rates on the marginal tax rates, that is, the rate at which new income is taxed, in order to increase real output, to give the incentive to increase real output. It worked.
It did work.
And we had really, for the rest of that century, we had a growth in real output without having to pay for it with rising rates of inflation. So that's what that was all about. Of course, Reagan was demonized by the left for cutting taxes for the rich. I don't think they ever understood what was at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually demonized by Republican establishment for the deficit. They never understood what that was about. So he kind of mm-hmm. caught it from both ends and subdued the supply siders.
Well, to jump from then to today, as one of the central figures of the Reagan years and as a man who's been in conservative groups, think tanks for decades, it's unusual, I think, for you to be writing along the lines that you've been writing in the past couple of years, where you're very, very skeptical. Skeptical is too mild a term, actually.
Highly critical
Of the government. I think on a couple of points, probably on free trade for one, you've changed your views, but I think that on many others, you've more or less been consistent all along. And I'm wondering how, as a Reagan conservative, and my guess is that you would probably still describe yourself as a Reagan conservative, but correct me if I'm wrong, how did you come to the positions that you hold today, and when did you begin to...
I can very easily explain that. First of all, I'm not sure what a Reagan conservative is, but there are none in the current government.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been an independent thinker. Mm-hmm. Conservatives were incapable of coming up with a supply-side policy.
Hmm.
That was too big of a change. It was too far outside of the box that they live in.
Hmm.
So it was not a conservative policy. It was the policy of a very few people who could think independently, both of the left and the right.
Interesting.
And we had nothing. It has nothing to do with being conservative. The supply side policy is an innovative. It's a revolution,
mm-hmm.
and nothing like that can possibly come out of a conservative. So, and it couldn't have come out of the left because of ideological reasons. They would not have cut
taxes,
rates,
right?
Even to stop stagflation, they would have rather had stagflation than to cut the tax for the rich.
Right.
So you had them. Their minds were blocked by ideology, and essentially so were the conservatives, but for different ideological reasons. So it was not a conservative thing. It was innovative. Now, I haven't changed. I've always been willing to hold people accountable. And you know, truth is not partisan.
Right.
What's happened in our society today is everybody thinks it is. So if I say something that's critical of Bush, they say, oh, you're just a liberal Democrat.
Uh-huh.
They don't know that, you know, I was a principal figure in the Reagan administration and a contributing editor of National Review and associate editor of the Wall Street Journal. And
right.
they don't know any of that. So they go by what you say. So if you point out a truth, even a truth, totally documented, irrefutable truth about the Bush administration, and it's critical, they just say, well, that can't be true. You're just expressing a liberal viewpoint. And it works the other way, too,
mm-hmm.
You see. So you have this association of anything anybody says with some partisan political position or some ideological position. So it looks like I've changed, but I haven't. It's still... I just call it as it is.
Well, that makes sense to me. I guess it would probably be fair to say that the theme of what you've been writing for the last couple of years is this, that if the United States doesn't really change the way that we do business, both politically and economically, that the country's headed for ruin, probably sooner than later. And
it may already be ruined in some economic sense. Let's get to that, if I
mm-hmm.
can. Let me
yeah.
first say, though, it's not that I've changed my mind on free trade.
Okay.
What I have pointed out is that free trade rests on specific conditions.
Mm-hmm.
That the case only is true if those conditions hold.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been the situation with economic theory of free trade. And what I've pointed out repeatedly is that neither of the two necessary conditions any longer hold. So there is no case any longer for free trade in the current world because the conditions on which it is based aren't there. That's the position I've taken. I've also taken the position that offshore production for American markets and job outsourcing has nothing to do with free trade.
What you call labor arbitrage.
It's labor arbitrage. Free trade rests on comparative advantage. I don't have time to explain that.
Sure.
But labor arbitrage is a case of absolute advantage. And all of the theorists of free trade have always said that if capital is internationally mobile, you will be confronted with absolute advantage, not comparative advantage. So the conditions for comparative advantage no longer exist, and therefore we don't have there's no case any longer for free trade. All that's happening is Americans are losing job opportunities, particularly at the upper end.
Mm-hmm.
We're simply going to end up a third world economy. In fact, we're very close to that already. I think that the export capacity of the United States economy is now so depleted,
mm-hmm.
there may be no exchange rate at which we can balance our trade.
Well, you have people like the president of the St. Louis Fed, for example, I forget his name, last December, giving a very convoluted argument in a speech about why it's possible to unwind the current account deficit without any major problems. But I think that a lot of that argument hinges on the fact that everybody uses dollars, and if people decided that they didn't want to use dollars anymore, we'd really have a whole different set of problems.
Right now, China or Japan, either one, can destroy the United States by dumping their holdings of dollar-denominated assets.
Mm-hmm.
They could send interest rates to infinity and the exchange rate of the dollar, you know, down to the center of the earth. So,
and what's holding them back from that?
What's holding them back from it is that they still see benefits to them of propping up the dollar.
Right.
Because they're gaining more and more of our markets. I mean, look, General Motors and Ford are on the verge of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically taking over. Now, the whole problem is, as we lose all the higher value jobs,
mm-hmm.
the consumer market is going to be gone. That is,
nobody has money.
It'd be worth anything to have the American markets because they're not going to be very strong. You know, for the last 5 years, there's been a decline in median household income.
Mm-hmm.
And amazing. What has kept the economy going is consumers are going deeper into debt and they're spending their home equity.
Right.
So that can't continue.
And
see what I'm saying?
That seems to be happening with a number of European countries, too, where the recent strength they've shown is in large part due to their housing market. But anyway.
I don't know if they have all the financing we have and mm-hmm. the ability to pull the equity out. I don't know, but it could well be. But Europe has a different set of problems. They're a little more resistant to outsourcing, but it's affecting them, too. Here, it's running rampant. For example, in the last 5 years,
mm-hmm.
the major sources of new jobs have been construction, and most of those have gone to Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
There have been health care, largely, you know, hospital orderlies and social assistants.
Right.
And bartenders and waitresses. That's the source of new jobs in America. In the last 5 years, the economy has been able to create only 958,000 net new jobs, net of the lost jobs.
Mm-hmm.
State and local government has created 1.1 million. So we have about 2 million new jobs created over a five-year period. This is the slowest. This is the worst job growth on record. And the records go back, I think, to 1939.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see happening is there's no place for university graduates. The mainstay for university graduates now is bartenders, waitresses, and temps.
What surprises me is this is all a fact, and yet it seems that somehow it hasn't registered with the public, that people believe what our elected leaders say in Washington when they say, oh, things are great, the economy is growing strongly, and so on and so forth. It's very hard to find news reports. I've seen you on CNN with Lou Dobbs talking about this, but he's a rarity too. There are very few people who talk about it.
Yes, there are very few people who talk about it, but a lot of people know it. I get every time I write a column about it, I get masses of emails from high school students, college students, their parents.
Hmm.
They all say, please tell us what skills can we acquire that can't be outsourced? They all know the problem.
Mm-hmm.
My own son went off to university to be an engineer, and he said, Dad, it's pointless. There's no jobs. You can't get a job. So, and the engineering enrollments at the prestigious schools like MIT and Georgia Tech are declining.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had massive declines. At the minute the foreign students no longer come to American engineering schools, they'll just close their doors. So we're losing the skills that define a first world country. Now, one of the reasons you don't hear much about it is that the big corporations, they all want the outsourcing. Wall Street wants it. And all the shareholder groups, all these activist shareholder groups, they want it because it drives up returns. If you can replace your American workforce with people in China or India or Eastern Europe or the Philippines, then you have a tremendous reduction in labor cost and earnings go up. And so what you have going now is the American managers are laying off the American workers, hiring foreigners in their place, and collecting huge bonuses for reducing labor costs.
Right, so the investor class does fairly well, and then
the
top managers...
The investor class does well. I get hundreds of emails from American engineers who've either gone through this or are going through it, and even the ones who get to keep their jobs, they write and say, well, the whole atmosphere has changed. They've brought in... It's really now engineering is run by the Indians, and they treat us like dirt, and our American managers collect the bonuses while we're treated like dirt. And so...
Basically training other people to do your jobs, and then you're fired.
And then you're fired, or if you, So what has already happened, that the sort of knowledge chain, career chain, where new engineers come into the system, they get jobs, they get experience, they move up, that's all broken now for Americans. That just doesn't work anymore. It's completely gone. And so people are abandoning these occupations. When you hear that there's a shortage of science and engineering, that's a lie. It's a great lie.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear that the solution is more training for scientists and engineers, that's fraudulent. The problem is there's no jobs for Americans in these occupations.
It's pretty amazing. I was reading an article, I don't know, a month ago about some industrious business that wanted to bring in software engineers from India and other places and couldn't get all the H-1 visas that they needed. So their solution was to park these fellows in a cruise boat outside the U.S. territorial waters and just have them work from there.
Well, yes, do that or just have them work in India. See, I don't think they have any trouble getting the ones they want now because in addition to the H-1B visas, they have what they call L-1 visas.
Mm-hmm.
And an L-1 visa lets them simply hire people abroad. They can just open an office somewhere and hire people. And then they can say, well, we're bringing our foreign people here to learn on the job. So that's open-ended, too. You see what I'm saying? There's no way around it. I hear from a lot of readers that it's now true even for school teachers and nurses that local school districts who have budget problems and hospitals who are forced to treat all the illegals freely.
Right.
What they do now, to avoid paying American salaries, they just bring in teachers from abroad. They bring in nurses from abroad. So even the kinds of hands-on jobs that people would think would be secure, they're now... Americans are being forced out of those.
This process is snowballing, though. It's a huge movement, and it doesn't seem that anybody wants to stop it, to get in the way of it.
It's a huge movement. There are now these huge Indian firms that have what they call job platforms. Actually, most of the H-1B visas are acquired by these Indian firms.
Mm-hmm.
And then they use them to recruit Indians, and then they come in and offer them to the American firms. So the whole process, even as intended by Congress, has been subverted, and it is out of control. And these people now have tremendous funds to make political contributions. They have diplomatic clout. We're trying to get India to go along with our attacks on Iran, mm-hmm. either through sanctions or militarily. And
right.
And so the Indians say, well, don't crack down on our job platforms. Don't you do anything about the outsourcing of your jobs. This is helping India. Everyone takes advantage of the sort of warmongering policy of the Bush administration to get what they want, so nobody can do anything about the Americans losing all the jobs.
Just the other day, the French denied a request by an Indian company to come in and buy up a French manufacturing concern on the grounds that the Indians weren't going to contribute anything, but were just going to sort of loot the company.
Yeah.
But you don't see that kind of attention here in Washington.
No, you don't. There's this, everyone is brainwashed with this ideology of free trade. They're too stupid to know that the conditions on which the case rests are no longer present. And they're too cowardly to stand up. So you have a situation where we think we are benefiting from what we think is free trade. I've had endless debates with economists of good standing,
right,
who think that we're benefiting from this. And you say, okay, if we're benefiting, how come there's no job growth for 5 years in any American export industry? You would think at least if there are mutual benefits, that at least part of our economy in export industries or import competitive industries would be benefiting and thereby adding jobs. And they don't say, they don't reply. They just repeat some shibboleth or they...
Well, I guess the bottom line is that they figure, okay, we're giving other people green pieces of paper and we're getting stuff for it, so what's wrong with that? And of course, what's wrong with it is that eventually the people getting green pieces of paper will say, well, we want some real stuff in return, and at that point, we may not be able to provide any.
Yeah, we can't now. I really do think that there's no exchange rate now that would balance the U.S. trade.
Hmm.
Because we have lost the export capacity. I mean, to produce, just the manufacturing is so depleted. What can we make to sell? That's the whole issue, isn't it? Almost every product you buy that has an American brand name,
mm-hmm.
nothing about it is made in America. It might be assembled, or some pieces of it might be assembled here, but things that you think of are American are not made here. They're not made with American labor. They're not made with American parts.
But how difficult could it be to fix that in some ways? I mean, if you go, for example, into a kitchen supply store and look around at the medium end of little gadgets, there's lots of stuff that's made in Italy or Germany or wherever, and you can buy something for $10, $15. Now, if they can make something that people want in their kitchen and sell it here in the United States at a profit, surely we would have similar opportunities if we set our minds to it.
You see, the American firms do make them, but they make them in Korea or China or somewhere else.
Hmm.
So it's not that the American firms don't make these. They just don't make them with American labor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole point. That's what outsourcing is. That's what offshore production is. It's the substitution of foreign labor for American labor in making goods for the American market, so mm-hmm. that effectively American labor is being separated from the incomes associated with the goods and services that they consume.
Mm-hmm.
And so you reach a point when the incomes don't support much consumption. And, as you pointed out earlier, if the dollar hits the skids as reserve currency,
mm-hmm.
You will see an amazing hardship in the United States. The real living standards here would plummet.
Collapse, yeah. So you don't see any way to unwind the current account imbalance?
Not under any present policy, not under outsourcing, not under offshore production, not under the amazing trade deficit that accompanies that. You see, what one of the reasons for the exploding trade deficit is that every time you outsource something abroad, you take a domestic good or service and turn it into an import. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The goods and services that American firms have moved offshore count as imports when they come in. So about half of the explosion in the trade deficit is simply the offshore production and the outsourced jobs of American firms.
I remember it's a little bit different take on this kind of thing, but during President Reagan's first administration, I believe it was, there was a question of what to do with Harley-Davidson, which was in trouble. The Japanese, Honda in particular, were beginning to import large motorcycles that competed very successfully against Harley-Davidson. And I forget exactly what Reagan did, but he managed to protect Harley-Davidson. And, of course, now it's a tremendously successful company, has been for a long time, actually. Why can't we apply that same kind of practice to various other industries?
I think because of the ideology of free trade. I think the only thing that would save America at this point, and it may be very difficult because we've lost so much advanced manufacturing knowledge, the only thing I think could save us would be extremely high tariffs.
And
simply produce for our own markets. But you see, the CEOs of all the big firms now have this globalization ideology.
Right, they would howl.
They think that there's no constituency for protection among the large corporate firms. You see, everybody thinks, oh, the big firms, they always want protection. Well, not anymore. See, protection works against them because it prevents them from these massive reductions in their labor costs. So so any politician who wanted you see, all Americans forget that the United States prospered under protection. And even though I'm a free trader, if the conditions are present, I nevertheless know that we prospered under protection. That's how we became an industrial might. We no longer are mighty industrially. We're dependent on China for advanced technology products.
Amazing, yeah.
It's amazing. So if you could put in all this protection, there have to be tremendous high tariffs because of the labor advantage that China, for example, has. If you could get that in, past all the corporate interests who would oppose it, past all the free market economists who would denounce you, and past all the diplomatic pressures that would come from everywhere, China, India, and if Bush's main interest is to attack Iran, he's going to sacrifice American jobs to get the votes of China and India on the Security Council. He has already done that. It's impossible to expect Bush to say, oh, I'd rather save American industry than attack Iran. It's not true. He'd rather attack Iran. So there's practically speaking, there's nothing we can do because of Bush's agenda, because of the agenda of the big corporations, and because of the way the diplomatic situation is now configured.
Well, let's get to Iran in just a second, but to try to summarize this, I guess, would it be fair to say that the choice is between making the world safe for hot capital to move around versus making American jobs safe? Is that a fair way to put it?
Yes, you can put it that way. With this qualification, even hot capital in the end, American hot capital or first world hot capital, won't be safe. Think about it. Who needs a firm that ends up being nothing but a marketer in the United States of products made abroad?
Take Apple, for example.
Yeah, who needs this? Well, Apple still is extremely innovative.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's a brand.
It's a brand, but there's still something real there.
A lot of the tech discussion is about how the innovations are shifting. It's not just the
That's right.
The manufacturing.
Everything is shifting.
Yeah.
the research, development, design, exactly. innovation itself. And that's right. what I was saying. How, yeah. what is the safety of American capital when the firm is nothing but a marketer
mm-hmm.
of products designed and manufactured abroad? Nobody needs that firm. Why do the Japanese or the Chinese need that firm? They just bypass it.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically mm-hmm. the American firms, they're benefiting in the short run, but they're destroying themselves in the intermediate and long run. Do you
right.
see what I'm saying?
And I do, yes.
And that's what's happening. It's a total wipeout. But, you know, we have America alone in the world has this quarterly reporting put in as a reform to give shareholders the latest and most up-to-date information. The quarterly reporting forces all attention of all American managers and corporate executives on the next 3 months. How can we have those results look good?
Or cook the books.
Yeah, or cook the books. But how do we make those look good so they don't see beyond that? There isn't any strategic plan for America. We're helpless when we are faced with governments like China and Japan who don't operate that way, who say, how are we going to be on the top in the long run?
20 years, 30 years, yeah, sure.
And so, you see, part of the problem, too, is that we came out of World War II as the only country that could make anything. There wasn't any capacity anywhere else to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have total monopoly. And so we couldn't help but benefit from trade.
We were fairly generous about the whole situation, too.
That's true, but it was largely part of the Cold War strategy to keep the Soviets from making gains. We would give more and more away.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we're no longer in that position. We don't have this. We don't have a monopoly on anything.
Well,
the skills have moved out.
Yeah, we have military power, basically.
It's not even clear we have that. I mean, we've got, 8 or 10 United States divisions backed up by all kinds of armor and air power, and they're tied down by a few thousand ragtag insurgents.
Yeah.
This is a demonstration of anything but military power.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move on to the Iran debacle and the Iraq debacle. A lot of us saw this Iraq thing coming way before it happened. Certainly at the time when we now know Bush had made the decision to go ahead, it was pretty clear to a lot of people outside the government that he had made that decision. In my observation and talking to people like General Odom and Ray McGovern and others, I think there are an awful lot of people who understand that the government was taken for a ride by the neocon faction. How that happened is something of a puzzle, but they managed to do it. And Bush is going along with it. He seems to like being a war president. But the whole thing from beginning to end is a catastrophe.
Yes, it's a catastrophe, and it's one that's building, because if they attack Iran,
mm-hmm.
they just multiply the problems and the anger. And if Iran fights back, I mean, it has far more ways of upsetting things in Iraq yet. So
it could upset things in Iraq. It could affect shipping through the Persian Gulf.
It could close down all the export of oil from the entire Middle East if it uses its missiles to take out those facilities. So there's a tremendous. I mean, it's really Iraq was reckless, and Iran is reckless to the 10th power.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to see that. Why is this happening? One, the neocons, the neoconservatives, they are Jacobins. They're like the French revolutionaries who think they have the right and the obligation to impose their system on the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the French Revolution ended up in the long Napoleonic Wars.
Well, they have that direct intellectual lineage from Trotsky.
That's right. That's right. World Revolution. So they are Jacobins, and they have this. They are also in their agenda is Israeli hegemony in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
That's also, they've been very clear about it. It's written in their papers. it's known, and they're very close and long-term ties to the CUD Party.
There's no doubt about it.
This isn't anything but a fact that's easy to document.
It's very hard to talk about that because you'll get blasted here in Washington and other places if you start talking about the connections the neocons have to Israel. Or, you know, I mean, you can step back and say...
I don't think anybody cares about that anymore.
Really?
You know, by definition, all non-Jews are anti-Semite. I mean, that's just the definition.
It sure seems that way.
And in fact, now, even Jews who aren't Zionists are considered to be anti-Semites.
Right, right.
So we now have even Jews called anti-Semites. So what does it mean if they call me one? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who says anything, the slightest critical of Israel, is an anti-Semite. Well, you need to go read the Israeli press.
They're more free than we are here.
They are far more critical of Israel than we are.
Sure. Yeah, it's amazing.
Haaretz, for example,
mm-hmm.
or any of the large number of peace groups in Israel. And, of course, they speak much more freely than we can, and they're far more critical because they're scared by the consequences of this policy. Rightly so, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I no longer care if they call me an anti-Semite. Everybody except Zionists are anti-Semite.
Well, good for you. Good for you.
So that doesn't matter. But if we have the combination, see, we have the Jacobin spirit, we have the Israeli hegemony, and we have Karl Rove. If you go back to prior to 9/11, it looked like Bush was going to be wiped out by the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a very weak position. A lot of people thought that they had stolen the election. He was elected by one Supreme Court vote.
Right.
The Democrat line was that he was illegitimate president, and it looked like he was going nowhere. 9/11 rescued him.
Right.
Karl Rove knew that instantly. He said, aha, this is the shield. They can't be against the guy who's protecting them from terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center and attacked the Pentagon. And so they have used this kind of fear and hysteria. And this is Bush's shield. As long as he's got that, he gets away with whatever he wants. He tells Congress, I don't have to obey your laws. I'm not accountable to your oversight. I don't have to obey the Constitution. And nobody does anything about it. And it's all because of the interpretation placed on 9/11.
Well, this gets into some rather dark and murky waters, but I was surprised, very surprised, to be honest, when I was talking with Ray McGovern, and he started to go on about all the anomalies in 9/11 and how the standard story didn't make sense. And at the time, I wasn't really sure I wanted to talk about all that, so I steered the conversation elsewhere. But just to make a note of it, there are a lot of really smart people with sterling credentials who have noticed that there are difficult problems with the 9/11 story that the standard explanation can't account for. And just yesterday, in the Miami Herald, there was a column, 9/11 attacks avoiding the hard question. So this kind of thinking is sort of percolating slowly into the mainstream. Just as a personal thing, right after the events, I went down across from the Pentagon. There's a sort of a raised hill, I don't know, maybe 40 feet off above the highway there, and people were going and laying wreaths and looking at the building and everything. And so I drove down and took a look, and I must say that I find it very difficult to imagine, and I'm not an expert on aircraft accidents, but I do have some experience in observing things, and just looking at that, it did not look to me like a major airliner went into that building. So,
yeah, I suppose you know about this these 9/11 scholars.
Yeah.
Who they're physicists. Even includes the German defense minister and the head of the German Secret Service. It's a wide variety of people with impressive credentials, and they say the 9/11 Commission report is a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have not really, you know, I've been worrying about jobs and foreign policy, and I haven't really looked at it very close, but I did go to Georgia Tech, and I did learn some physics. And I know enough physics to know that it is strictly impossible for buildings to collapse in their own footprint
mm-hmm.
at free fall speed,
mm-hmm.
except under controlled demolition.
Mm-hmm.
Those buildings did not come down the way the 9/11 report says. It's strictly impossible. In fact, it's a total. The account in the 9/11 report is a total contradiction to the laws of physics.
You know, recently, without going into a whole lot of detail about this, because I'm not an expert on it either, but I did notice that New York City, I guess after some legal wrangling, finally released late last year the oral history statements by a number of people who had been working in the towers. And it's fascinating because there are people who were on the mechanical engineering staff who were in the lower levels, and before the buildings had fallen, they reported seeing explosions and 5-ton doors that had been wrinkled like tissue paper and various kinds of machine tools that had been vaporized. So there was some kind of explosion down there before the buildings fell.
Yeah, the oral histories, I've seen there are some reports on that and read some of them, and they all say that they heard a series of explosions floor by floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's controlled demolition.
So we have
there's
to
no other way
to
explain.
Yeah.
See, most people don't even know. They think the only buildings that fell were the two towers.
Right, but you have Building 7.
Yeah. But Building 7 was hit by nothing, and same thing happened.
And that would be, it's the first time ever that a building sort of on its own due to fire, a steel structure building would collapse, and you'd think that the engineering profession would want to know why.
If you know, they'll talk, some of them will tell you privately, but if they say it publicly, they lose clients for their firms because everybody gets mad. You're against the government. You're
right.
Against the country.
Right, right.
You're a traitor. You don't believe Bush. You know, this is what happens. So they don't say anything. The physicists in the universities, very few of them can say anything because they all live on government grants.
Right.
People don't understand how hard it is in America to speak the truth. It's almost impossible.
That's right, yeah.
Everywhere you go, you see, I'm not allowed to even write about it by my editors.
Is that so?
So that's one reason I don't know much about it. But it doesn't. I tried to find out something once, and I pointed out some of the really major holes in the story, and they just said, don't write about it. You're not allowed to write about it. You'll ruin your credibility. Everybody say you're a conspiracy theorist, and then they won't believe what you say about jobs.
Well, you know, I was really impressed with the book by David Ray Griffin. There's a guy.
Yeah, he's very brave.
He's very brave, and he's a mainstream theologian. He was a professor for 30 years at Claremont Graduate School, teaching the logic of religion. He's known as a
But what, you know, his problem is he's not a physicist or a structural engineer. So they say, well, how do you know? And yeah. Since they don't know themselves, they can't tell whether he knows or not. Do you see?
Yeah.
The real breakthrough, I think, has been some of the physicists who stood up, like this professor Stephen Jones at BYU.
BYU, yeah. Although they muzzled him pretty quickly.
They muzzled him quickly. It's very easy to see why. The federal government calls up and says, do you realize how many research grants the university gets from the federal government?
Yeah. So it's tough because you need a theory to beat a theory, and what we've got are a set of observations that the current story is implausible, but it's so hard to come up with a scenario that would explain and account for all these things. You know, who did it? Why did they do it? All that. It's a really tough one.
I think the evidence is unequivocal,
mm-hmm.
that controlled demolition was used to bring down those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we know who wired them or why or what. I mean, maybe they were wired in the event that something crashed into them and they started to topple and destroy half of Lower Manhattan, and so they wanted to have some way to bring them down. Maybe that had been done, and maybe something set it off.
It's a thought.
Maybe the attack set it off, or maybe the people panicked and decided to bring them down. But it didn't happen. I don't know why and what, and I have no theory. All I know is, mm-hmm. it didn't happen the way they say it happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad we talked about that. Okay, well, let's go on with Iraq and Iran. And I wanted to look at one other aspect of the Iranian thing, and that is the extent to which China has its eye on Iranian oil, and China is involved then in whatever we do with regard to Iran. I know you've noticed the book Petrodollar Warfare by William Clark and praised it. It's interesting. He's a guy who doesn't have experience in these areas, but he's brought together a number of notions in a very original way. And I think that his point about the Chinese interest in Iran is pretty well taken. Could you comment on that?
Well, let me take it in a very general way.
Okay.
I think that the Russians and the Chinese, along with the rest of the world, think that we're insane. Everyone knows that Iran hasn't any nuclear weapons or any nuclear weapon program. That's what the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors themselves have said. Mm-hmm. Iran is cooperating in the sense that they allow all of the inspections under the treaty, and under the treaty they have the right to nuclear energy. So what we're doing is saying, well, we're not going to let you have the treaty rights because we don't trust you.
I guess if you read between the lines, what the U.S. and particularly the Israelis are worried about is if the Iranians get past a certain threshold where they understand the cycle and then at their leisure could begin to accumulate enriched uranium.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult if you're subject to constant inspections.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I think that what we have a different agenda, and we're using this to set them up. There's no basis to the American objection except they want war. That's the only reason. Now, the question is, why will the rest of the world let us have it? Well, it's not in Russia or China's interest to have their oil agreements with Iran disturbed. On the other hand, it is in their interest for us to dig ourselves into a deeper hole.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because if the oil is disrupted in the Middle East, any bit of it, it makes Europe that much more dependent on Russia. And Russia, of course, is already bothered by us taking bases, NATO bases, to their frontier. Well, the minute the NATO countries are totally dependent on Russia for oil and gas, that's the end of our influence in Europe.
That's a good point.
So Russia has a lot to gain, probably more to gain than lose, by letting Bush start a war with Iran.
Hmm.
China, too, because they will be financing the war. We don't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
All of this $500 billion Bush is talking about is going to be barred from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. Fine, let us get in deeper. It's easier for them to take Taiwan.
And any remaining American industry that they'd like.
That's right. And if we say anything about it, they'll say, oh, we've got $1 billion in treasury bonds. We don't want them anymore. Would you like to buy them back? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's not, we're not in a defensible position. So I think there's a, and of course the Europeans are just pressured every which way, trade agreements, everything else, to go along with our attack on Iran. So everybody's interest is served by letting Bush create a worse disaster for the United States and for the Iranians. And so it may happen.
Hmm.
And the consequences, of course, are disastrous because it's a war crime. Unprovoked aggression is a war crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wars based on lies discredit the government, the concept of democracy. We already have Bush saying that his powers as commander-in-chief are not restrained by statutory law or by the Constitution.
All these signing statements, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, plus signing statements that this law doesn't apply to me if I don't want it to. We now have, just the other day, you know, he refused to turn over documents to a congressional investigation, stating in effect that he was no longer subject to congressional oversight.
Oh, you're talking about the Katrina documents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you won't even turn over hurricane documents because you're not subject to oversight, what is he subject to?
Yeah.
He's become totally unaccountable.
Yeah.
What's to make him hold elections?
I worry about that too, yeah.
I mean, if he can pick up people anywhere in the world without a warrant, hold them in indefinite detention wherever he wants,
torture
without
them,
producing any evidence,
kill them maybe.
He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
So we've already got a person behaving as if he's a dictator. And we're seeing very little opposition to this. Very, very little opposition.
It's very sad. Yeah.
It's scary. It makes you wonder, what if there's another terrorist event, either real or staged? whatever, another terrorist event, you could see very easily that they would say, well, look, it's too dangerous to hold an election.
Well, I think that they've had plans to take care of that situation for a while. They just haven't dared to use them. But
it really depends on how long they continue to fool roughly half the population.
On the off chance that Congress would find a spine and go ahead and impeach Bush, then after that, I would hope that he would be tried in court, starting with war crimes and going on from there, and then be sent to jail. Would that
be?
Yeah,
I think he and the entire government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if they don't impeach him, the America will have seen the end of the separation of powers, that the Congress will become a rump like the Roman Senate under the Caesars.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on the verge of that right now. Now, that sounds like, oh, how could that possibly be in the United States? We have liberty and democracy, blah, blah. So did the Roman Republic. But it's very easy to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose it by giving in to executive claims of power. And that's what we're doing. Of course, it's been going on a long time, but it's really bad now. I mean, it's really accelerating. And it's not done under cover. The cover is 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only cover for this. And when it's happened in the past, it's had other kinds of things. And it wasn't the blatant issue that it is now. But what we see now is he's simply saying, I'm not accountable, and he can even flout his criminality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not obeying the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I'm not obeying it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't apply to me.
I'm kind of skeptical that the Democrats on their own can do this. I think that to remedy the situation, you'd really have to have a bipartisan group. But how could one get the Republicans to...
I don't think they will, you see, because it's different now from Nixon's time. In Nixon's time, there was a lot of just corruption and power grabbing and all the rest, but there were still some people who had some thought to the country,
mm-hmm.
who were still imbued with constitutional principles and thought they're important. Today it's just power.
Right.
Republicans are interested in nothing but power.
Power and money, yeah.
Power. They're not even interested in money, except as it helps power.
Hmm.
See? So if you have a party that's totally motivated by power and being in power, and we've got power, by God, we're not giving it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, you know, they've got both houses and the presidency. So I think if the American people don't put Congress in the hands of Democrats, or at least one house, in this November,
yeah,
that we will have a dictatorship.
Hmm. Well, Paul, how do your former Republican colleagues react when they hear you say stuff like this? I'm sure that doesn't really matter to you, but do your friends from earlier times disown you?
Well, some of them agree. Some of them agree with me.
Uh-huh.
Some of the Reagan people agree. I mean, look, Pat Buchanan has been very outspoken.
He flips and flops around a little bit on this.
Well, he has to survive. He's in Washington.
He does. That's true.
See, I'm not there anymore.
Yeah.
If I was in Washington, I'd probably have to be flipping back and forth, too.
Mm-hmm.
But still, he speaks out.
He does, yes.
And I know, and some others up there that have been active for their whole life in Republican, not the politics side, but the policy side, you know, the policy walks. Some of those, they send my stuff around, despite the opprobrium that comes back on them for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some. And I get emails from Republicans and who lifelong Republicans, so they can't believe this guy.
Right.
This is happening. I get it. So.
Actually, I know a few like that myself.
And a lot of World War II vets and Vietnam vets, they write in and say, how is this happening? This is not what we fought for.
Mm-hmm.
So some people do see it. Not everyone is blind. And, of course, but Washington today is just power, power, power. And so they probably just think, oh, poor Craig, he could have been part of the power. But look what he did. He went and got on the wrong side of us. So there's no power for him.
Hmm.
So that's probably all they think. They probably just think I'm a fool who gave up all my connections and associations with power. That's probably the way they see it. I doubt they think that I'm much of a danger because I don't have a New York Times forum, an ABC forum.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It's the, and the president has endless propagandists. He's got Fox News, CNN, the networks, all the corporate media.
Mm-hmm.
See, Americans, too, don't understand that in the 1990s, that was the end of the American media because the government permitted massive concentration. So now there's a few corporate hands control the media.
Right.
They're not going to risk their broadcast licenses
by
getting
not.
On the wrong side of the government.
Very valuable. Yeah.
And they're not going to risk their advertising revenues by being controversial. The last thing they want is to be attacked as being unpatriotic or against the president. So the news people, so-called news they get, is a very carefully controlled line.
But now my experience, when I left the State Department and resigned over Yugoslav policy and went around, my experience is that just as an individual, that you can really affect public opinion if you're determined about it. And it's a kind of a funny thing. Call it a meme or whatever. You get an idea and you start broadcasting it in various ways. You go and talk to people and small groups, write articles, whatever. And that can have a major impact. Just take an example the other day, Rowan Atkinson in the UK. I don't know if you were following this at all, but there was a question of how much the British Parliament was going to control so-called hate speech. And Rowan Atkinson, who's a comedian, went on the offensive about this. And finally, the Blair proposal was defeated in the Commons by two votes, one of 10 votes and the other of a single vote. But you can chalk it all up, really, to Rowan Atkinson's opposition. So I think that there's a kind of a mysterious way in which different ideas adapt to circumstances in ways that the people in power don't expect.
Well, yes, the pen is mightier than the sword, as the old saw, and I hope it's true, and mm-hmm. I agree with that. I would only say that there's a difference between the situation in Britain and the one here. We now have a new ideological movement, the neoconservatives. This is a Jacobin movement, just like the French Revolution. It's Jacobin. It's just as deadly and dangerous. They have massive media allies. They control the Republican Party and the White House. Plus, they have the great fear and hysteria of the Americans of terrorists after 9/11. The Brits didn't have a 9/11. You can say, oh, well, they had the subway bombing.
Mm-hmm.
But they've had bombings for decades because of the IRA.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They know that a bombing doesn't threaten the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably don't think the Muslims will ever be the threat the IRA was.
Right.
So it doesn't produce the kinds of fear and hysteria and, oh, please take all the power and protect me. It doesn't have that effect on them. Plus, they're just a much more outspoken people, despite the slander laws that they live under. And there's not any sort of penalty for jumping all over the government. They're not going to have the conservative flag waving half the population say, you're a traitor, you're unpatriotic, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. They haven't heard that in England in eons, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But here, you see, anything you say that's critical, oh, you're against America, why don't you go move to Cuba?
Yeah. Well, there's a
mindlessness here that doesn't exist there.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that the neocons are supremely organized. You've got to give them that. They're really very determined about the way that they operate beneath the radar, and it's not an ad hoc informal thing as much as it is a really deliberate.
It's a conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then secondly, you've got in the American public, unfortunately, of not a plurality, but perhaps but a large percentage of the population who are really too dumb to think about anything, maybe 30%, whatever Bush's core support is. And I think you could still get things done without involving them, but it's kind of difficult, and most politicians don't really think about it that way.
Well, they think about their careers. Who am I going to upset? Who's going to get on my case? Plus, you got to ask yourself this. How long has Bush been using the NSA to spy on people?
Mm-hmm.
The entire time of his presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's not just something he's done for the last year. He's been doing this since he's been there. So since he can spy just as easily by going to the court as by not going, he doesn't gain any ability to spy on terrorists by refusing to obey the law.
Clearly, yeah.
Why does he refuse to obey the law? Because he's not spying just on terrorists. He's spying on the Democrats, the media.
members
he's
of Congress.
Getting all kind of blackmail material to shut them up.
Right.
I think this is the explanation of why the Democrats are so feeble. I have never seen a party so feeble when they had so many targets and opportunities.
That's true. But I wouldn't chalk it all up to blackmail, not yet anyhow. I think that they're just congenitally feeble that way for some reason.
But they never were.
Well,
look, if Reagan had done a fraction of this, he would have been impeached. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. You mean, Mr. President, you lied to us about weapons of mass destruction so you could attack a sovereign country and cause all this death and all of this turmoil throughout the Middle East? We don't know what the end of it will be. You did that, you're impeached. There's no doubt about it. Reagan would have been impeached.
But even back in the 80s, it was possible for members to be thrown out based on public sentiment. And now, I mean, they might as well all belong to the Politburo because they never get voted out. So it's much harder for a representative to take into consideration what their constituents might think.
Well, I suppose that's true. It's more and more controlled. Maybe that's why the Congress is more and more supine. But what it means is if somebody in the executive branch tends to run away with power, there's nothing to stop him,
mm-hmm.
particularly if he's loaded up the court that will approve it.
Mm-hmm. And dared the Congress to stop him. And
dare, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So this is a terrible thing to say, but I think the only real point of optimism is that he bites off more than we can chew. That they attack Iran and Iran doesn't just take it.
Mm-hmm.
It actually does many of the things that it can do, or that it doesn't wait till it's too late. Maybe Iran will preempt something.
Mm-hmm.
And then that the anger and the turmoil upset our puppets throughout the region. Our puppet in Egypt, our puppet in Pakistan,
right.
in Jordan, our Saudi puppets. And you see a tremendous turmoil, and you see you see a complete catastrophe that they can't spin him out of. I mean, this is entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody could do anything about Hitler. The plots of the German high command couldn't even get rid of him.
Yeah.
Until he marched into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And he destroyed himself.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe letting the neocons march Bush off into the Middle East, we'll take on Iran and Iraq and Syria, and we'll take on Hamas, and we'll take on Hezbollah and Lebanon, and we'll see what happens. Maybe that is the only way that we can...
The silver lining there. That's pretty depressing, but you may be right.
It's hard to see anything. There's no opposition one sees anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So it may well be that he has to just produce a general catastrophe. In the meantime, of course, the economy is bound to go sour because there's no growth in disposable income. The consumers are now so much in debt they can't borrow anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The housing bubble is
near the point
over,
of, yeah.
So they're not going to be able to pull out increasing equity from their homes to spend. So the economy is just sitting there, ready for a tumble. There are no jobs for anybody. Did you see the other day in Chicago, a new Walmart opened up just on the outskirts of the city, and they had 300 and something jobs advertised, and 25,000 people showed up?
Oh, my gosh.
25,000 people. And, you know, in Walmart, jobs aren't known to be very desirable.
No.
I mean, it's not your first choice of a job. So they had roughly 350 jobs they advertised. This is all in the Chicago Sun-Times on January 26th.
Mm-hmm.
So 25,000 people apply for 300 jobs. And in Oakland, a Walmart had a few jobs. 11,000 people applied. So this is not a good employment situation. The unemployment rate is meaningless because it doesn't count all the people who aren't collecting unemployment benefits,
mm-hmm.
who are now essentially out of the workforce.
Right.
They're called discouraged workers.
Right.
But they're really just people whose unemployment has run out.
So the actual figure is considerably higher.
Recently economists are estimating the unemployment rate in the United States. Actually, a government, one of the government agencies estimated it was about 8.5%. And the thing is, so many of them are college graduates and engineers who've been laid off. It's not like they're just high school dropouts. If they'd gone to school, they wouldn't be unemployed. Most of these are people who either worked all their life in blue-collar jobs, or they're recent college graduates, or they're laid-off engineers. And that's our unemployment.
Well, what kind of other precipitating event than Iran could cause the House of Cards to come down, do you think?
Well, Iran, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on the Iranian military, but I talk to people who are, and as I understand it, they have missiles,
right.
A number of missiles of long enough range and enough blast power to take out most of the oil facilities in the Middle East.
Well, they also have Chinese silkworm missiles that could knock out most ships. So,
yet they can attack our navy. They can close the Gulf of Hormuz either by sinking ships or just, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so that would disrupt a lot of oil flows. They can send we've turned Iraq over to the Shia, and the Shia are allied with Iran, so they can say, look, and the Shia have tolerated us because we're turning power over to them.
Right.
But Iran can say, look, this game's over. Go get them. So if the Shia join the Sunnis in attacking our troops, we may not get the army out.
There are a number of scenarios. I guess you've probably seen William Lynn's articles on this stuff.
Bill Lynn, I'm sure he can lay out a number of the scenarios. I'm sure that he'll have stuff like that in it.
Mm-hmm.
It would really depend on how aggressive they would want to be. It's not impossible that since our forces in Iraq now are so fragmented and dispersed, and that there's no real concentration of large numbers of troops in any one place,
mm-hmm.
that the Iranians could roll some divisions across the border and just roll up our troops before they could get organized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know they would be that aggressive, but they could certainly use their missiles to disrupt oil flows for a very long time. They could certainly set off the Shia in Iraq. They can set off Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is allied with them, and Hamas. So terrorism could explode, all over. People don't really realize how cooperative the Iranians have been.
Yeah.
They really have been cooperative. And
They're saying they want to play by the same rules everybody else is
playing. That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so to gratuitously go provoke them into a war. Remember, too, the Sunni insurgency that's tied down 8 or 10 U.S. divisions is drawn from a population of 5 million Sunnis. That's all there are. The population of Iran is 70 million. So if we can't subdue an insurgency drawn from a 5 million people in Iraq, how are we going to subdue Iraq with 70 million people? How many millions of troops are we talking about for the United States?
Well, we haven't got them.
We haven't got them. Where are they going to get them? Draft. How many people are going to be happy if there's 1 million American troops marched off to Iran? I just don't know what they're thinking. Some people claim, they have a plan. The Bush people, because most of the Iranian oil is right there real close to Iraq, so we could rush in and grab it before they could do anything. And we could, and the Gulf of Hormuz is close, so we could rush in and secure that, and then they wouldn't do anything.
Well, in addition to the U.S., the big losers in this would be the Europeans. So don't you think that they would try to put the brakes on? Or?
You see, they would, but they don't. They always, as I said earlier, their problem is we'll close our markets to them, or we'll do this, we'll do that. There are so many threats that we can issue to them
mm-hmm.
that politicians, being what they are, the threat at hand is more scary than the others in the bush that you haven't got to yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so the threat at hand is more scary than what will be the oil consequences. And I've already said that'll be, of course, they'll fall under Russia.
Under Russia.
And that's why Russia may let us go ahead. They may say, okay, they want to create more trouble for themselves, let's let them do it. And that's why China may say, well, go ahead and create more trouble. It's easier for us. The more trouble you're in. So that, I think, is why these things.
Sounds like what we need here is a miracle.
We need a miracle, but there's no way to produce one. Look, you may be following these developments in the British press, for example, today in the London Times, this new book that's come out showing how Bush had the war in already planned
for the Korea,
which see Blair,
and
long before anything about Saddam Hussein ever got to the UN, the whole thing was planned in advance. Well. Mm-hmm. You would think this would bring down the government, but it doesn't. It's amazing to me it hadn't brought Blair down, because it's easy to bring down a British prime minister. We'd have to have impeachment.
Yeah.
But despite these horrors, and nothing happens. So where is the miracle? The only real miracle would be impeachment that stops this before it goes any further, and I don't think that's going to happen. So,
let me just switch gears for a second. What's your considered judgment about the religious right? The everything from the Christian supremacists, I guess you'd say they have a word for themselves, and all the rest of them.
Evangelicals.
Hmm?
The evangelicals.
The evangelicals. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the rapture theorists.
All of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they are not as unified force as we're often told. Some of the Christians, fundamentalists, write to me and say they're really disturbed by all this and that they think the rapture people are crazy. But, of course, the rapture people are all for a Middle Eastern war because they think that's the beginning of Armageddon and they're going to be wafted up to heaven.
Yeah.
And they can't wait. And the rest of us awful sinners are going to be left here to burn. So they'll go along with whatever Bush does as long as it's war in the Middle East. Now, you can say that's not a very Christian position, and
it's not.
It's not,
yeah.
But they're blind to that. They're just ready to be wafted to heaven. And then you have other fundamentalists who are basically all still keyed up over abortion, homosexuals, pornography, the general deterioration overall in behavior and manners and all the
evolution
words
in
the movies and television and the sex and sexual promiscuity. They're still all keyed up all over that, and one can understand that and why and even be sympathetic. But they then forgive Bush anything because he's going to deal with that. And for them, that's all that's really important, or that's the most important thing. And so they are willing to put up with whatever else Bush dishes out because he's going to do something about all those awful things. So it's a very firm support base for him among most of the Christian evangelicals.
Do you think that the mainstream Christians, the old-fashioned New England types, should be a little more public in their criticism of the evangelical politics, or?
Well, I don't know. I suppose they are, actually. I don't really know what they're doing. It could well be they're restrained by all the past efforts of ecumenicalism. And they may be restrained by the notion that somehow Christianity is under attack and they all got to stay together, or the Muslims will get them, or who knows what kind of notions people get. That might seem to them more important than the Constitution or the separation of powers or war crimes. Who knows?
I remember during the Vietnam War, it took them a while, but the mainstream, the traditional, let's say, Protestant churches were eventually quite outspoken and very active, and they have not been visible this time around.
Well, that was a draft war.
That's true, yeah.
So you had congregations that were upset because it was their sons drafted. You had the students in the streets. you had the leaders from religious departments in the universities. You may remember all of the names of the ones. And they had forums. Right now, where is the forum? It's not the New York Times isn't going to give them a forum. CBS isn't going to give them a forum.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's an interesting point.
The war is not... If you look at the recruits, increasingly, they're people that the military would never before take.
Yeah, people with criminal records and...
criminal records, extremely low IQs, no education.
Mm-hmm.
We even have a program now where we, if illegals sign up, we give them green cards and citizenship. So it's not, you know, if the military is increasingly, say, Mexican, it's not affecting Americans.
That's true, yeah.
So it's like the Caesars ended up with German mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it to the Romans?
Hmm. Well, I must say, I'd like to see the churches more involved, and I've complained sporadically to my church-going friends about this. I don't know. There may be some turning point for the churches, too. I went to a meeting of a Middle East committee of a local Congregationalist church the other day, and I was very struck by how angry some of the older people were that their pastor had not been engaged in these issues. It's kind of interesting, actually.
It's risky to go out there and be set. See, many people are still fighting the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my just conservative acquaintances, they just see this as a replay of Vietnam, and they determined this time not to lose to the protesters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is for them. I mean, I even know...
Except this time, the people who are most outspoken are not liberals, but conservatives. Really?
Well, that's true, because I think conservatives have always wanted to conserve the Constitution. If you look at it historically, liberals haven't been all that big a friend of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it gets in the way of them using power to advance their agenda. So the Constitution was in the way of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
So what won? The New Deal. So it's not that the liberals have a record in the 20th century of being staunch constitutional defenders. They have been defenders of civil rights or civil liberties. They certainly have. But of the Constitution per se, if it gets in the way of their agenda, it's all right to set it aside because the agenda is what's important. And they talk about the living Constitution and all. This is what the whole fight was about, original intent versus judges legislating. And the liberals wanted the judges to legislate their program.
Mm-hmm.
And the conservatives said, no, that's, you are supposed to interpret the Constitution as it's originally written. So basically, the conservatives are the people committed to the Constitution. I don't mean the neoconservatives. They could care a whit about it. But the real conservatives, and there are very few real conservatives left.
Mm-hmm.
They've been decimated. There's only one. I mean, how many conservative publications are there? There's a new thing called the American Conservative.
Right. Buchanan's
there. But you know, all the former conservative publications have been taken over by the neocons. All the conservative foundations have fallen to the neocons. No conservative can get past a neocon to get a university appointment.
Mm.
And certainly in the media, what conservatives are there in the media?
Yeah, you have one neocon arguing with another one. Yeah,
yeah, it's neocons versus neocons, or some weak-kneed liberal. So it's not anything there. That's basically the situation. It's just nothing. There's nothing there.
It goes back to out-organizing the opposition again, I guess. Instead of taking things for granted the way they used to be, to get a sense of being re-energized and you know, going into the fray. I'm just trying to think about it practically.
Well, I don't know anything about fundraising and all that, but where does the money come from? If the Democrats upset the corporations on outsourcing,
mm-hmm.
then they won't get any money. If they don't protect people's jobs, the people aren't going to flock to Democrats. So they seem, you see what I'm saying?
Well, it does seem like a catch-22, but...
where will their money come from? The unions are devastated and destroyed. There's not any unions mm-hmm. except public employee unions. The Bush people have been very aggressive about controlling the civil service.
Right. Super aggressive. Yeah.
I've never seen that before. I mean, never. When I was in the government, we couldn't do anything about the civil service. And so, but they're very aggressive in everything, the Bush people, and everything they do. So where does the money come from? For are the oil interests going to give the Democrats money? No. They why? Well, they might protect the environment, and we can't drill. Or they may not go along with the war. We won't get more oil there. I mean, who knows where the source of financing is for them? Do you see what I'm saying? The unions, which used to be important to them, are devastated and destroyed.
Well, it's clearly a problem. But to Dean's credit, for example, he's been going around locally to set up fundraising operations and organizations for local candidates. And so Howard Dean has been doing pretty good job of that, I think, at least trying to get something started.
Well, I don't know. It's fine with me if he is. But just think back how easily they destroyed him.
Yeah. Yeah, with the scream and all that.
Yeah, I mean, nothing. They didn't need anything to destroy him. It was just easily done, and the people fell for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to know. I don't know what the result's going to be. I do think the United States is headed to catastrophe, both in war and in the economy and in their form of government. And whether the catastrophe itself produces some upheaval and change, I don't know. But you see, if you have people who don't have jobs, who don't have any financial capabilities, who, even if they do have jobs, are hard-pressed to make any ends meet, there's not much strength in that population.
Well, it's true, but on the other hand, they don't have much left to lose, so they could become more active.
Well, yes, they could become more active. But
I don't know. It's very thought-provoking. I will point out one thing, that despite the gloomy prognosis that you've offered, you are still out there writing splendid articles all the time, and so you must be driven by some kind of optimism in some way, and so that encourages me.
Well, good. Look, you never give up fighting. You know, I always remember the old Anglo-Saxon poem, The Battle at Malvern Bridge,
mm-hmm.
when the Vikings are pressing the English, and the English are losing, and the old Earl says, well, as our numbers grow smaller, our will must grow stronger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think you have to fight for your country. It's patriotic to fight for your country, and your country is not your government.
Right.
And you can never confuse government with country, or patriotism with support of the government. You have to support your country, and your country is the Constitution, Bill of Rights, civil liberties, the separation of powers. That is what we inherited.
That's the historical enterprise, yeah.
It's our responsibility to defend that inheritance and pass it on to our own children. You know, I have children. I don't want them growing up in some oppressive, authoritarian-type society where they can tell you whatever lies they want and push you around however they want. That's not what I want to happen to anybody that I brought into the world. So I have a responsibility at least to them. That's the way I see it. So, yes, I fight.
Well,
I do what I can. And I will keep on.
Well, Dr. Roberts, on that note, which is a great note, I want to thank you again for speaking with me and Electric Politics thanks you. I certainly hope to see your articles and columns for many, many years to come. And I think that you're a great American. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That was very nice of you to say that. Thanks very much. And I really enjoyed talking with someone as intelligent as you are.
Well, okay.
I wish it happened more often.
Wow. This is thought-provoking and inspirational stuff. Pretty powerful. I can't thank Dr. Roberts enough for taking the time, and I hope to have him back again on the show. And I hope you found the conversation interesting and useful. I think it's a particularly important one, and if you agree, please help to get the word out by sharing the link with your friends. As always, I very much welcome your comments from the contact page on the Electric Politics site. You can find my email, regular postal address, and phone. Comments to the phone system may, if you want, be played on the air. You're also welcome to leave comments on the weblog column of the site under individual weblog posts. Turning to upcoming programming, I haven't yet got anything nailed down for the next show, but please stay tuned. Thanks very much for listening to Electric Politics.